Hello and welcome to Rock Writ episode 35. I'm your host Armin Savagin, so glad you could join us for yet another exploration in rock criticism and old school fanzine culture, and from the looks of it, the last one for 2023. Now, our guest today doesn't need an intro, but his fanzine probably does. You'll know Eric Friedel as one of the members of the late great Oblivions and the guy behind the Goner Records label and retail store, and of course the annual Goner Fest music festival in Memphis. And what you may not know about Eric is that in the early 90s he published an excellent fanzine called Wipeout. Now, Wipeout wasn't a fanzine I was familiar with. Fortunately, good friend of the show Jay Hinman helped correct that by sending me some scans. Thank you very much, dude. And it's an excellent publication. It actually has a lot in common with what Jay was doing in his 90s fanzine Super Dope, covering garage punk, Japanese noise, what have you, with a totally unique slant, all his own. And even when I'm not sure exactly what Eric is going on about, he's never less than aghast to read, getting me excited and pumped about this music, and really, what more could you ask for? The dude is truly one of the unsung voices from that early 90s fanzine explosion. So please enjoy this chat with Eric Wipeout Friedel on Rock Writ.
Hey, man.
What's up?
Not much. How are you?
I'm okay.
Good. Thank you so much for doing this. You've grown your hair. I've never seen you with... I mean, I've never seen you except in pictures, but every picture I've seen is medium length hair.
That's right.
Yeah. Respect. It looks good.
I decided to attempt to join my friend's metal band, Total Hell. they all had long hair, and I was like, I can do it. And it worked, actually. They asked me. I didn't tell them that. I just started growing my hair, and they asked me if I wanted to do a guitar solo on some recording in April. I said, sure. And then that never happened, but I thought that was pretty good.
It's a good look. And yeah, if you're looking to get picked up in a metal band, long hair will do it. Or my haircut. Yeah. You need a beard.
Yeah, something
pokey coming out of your chin.
Yeah.
Just researching this, I came across a ton of interviews you've done over the years, talking about like your exploits with Oblivions and Goner Fest and Goner Records. But how many of those interviews have brought up the fact that you're Eric Wipeout? How many does that ever come up? How many people in your life actually know about your fanzine infamy?
It's a weird group of people that were doing fanzines or putting out records from that time. Almost no one really plays up their, you know, hey, I used to do a fanzine, you know, that doesn't really get you much cred. I didn't know Tom Sharpling did a fanzine for the longest time, you know, all that kind of, you know, there's lots of people that are still doing great stuff, did fanzines, but it doesn't really come up. So, you know, it was a jokey fanzine anyway. So it's not really something that, you know, I want to pin my hat on at the end of the day. As the first thing you find out, I guess, I don't know, whatever.
Yeah. But it's important. It's important. That's why we're chatting about this. As he shakes his head. I'm always curious about people's kind of formative experiences with fanzines. I remember the first couple of things I picked up, Flipside and Maximum Rock and Roll in Buffalo, New York, at a Borders or Barnes & Noble. What was your early experience with fanzines, Eric?
That's a good question. I don't really remember. I grew up in Hawaii. I think people made little magazines in high school, but I don't really remember fanzines besides like Maximum Rock and Roll and things like that. And that always seemed more of a magazine. What I really liked was more of a personal kind of take on everything. And those kind of fanzines, I don't think I saw till a little bit later. You know, like Maz did Four Letter Words, kind of super pop thing from the bass player and the Mummies. And after I got out of school, a guy I ended up working with here in Memphis, Sherman Wilmot, he and I did a fanzine that was super, I mean, it was probably like 8 pages. But we got to talk to cartoonists that we liked and review music that we liked and things like that. So, you know, I don't necessarily remember a formative thing, but there was Flesh and Bones and some early fanzines that kind of were like, oh, okay, you could really go wild with this stuff and do whatever you want. And that's what appealed to me.
Mm-hmm. Flesh and Bones was just a really funny fanzine out of Jersey, right?
Yeah, I think so. I might have only seen a couple of copies, but I have this one, and I saw a picture of it the other day, maybe why I thought of it, but it's got Red Cross in it, and it's got these wild women and this guy on the cover. And I just found out that was Rob Kennedy from the Work Dogs, who I got to know kind of well. He came through Memphis a few times and lived in Hawaii recently. I don't think he lives there anymore, but anyway, I've had this thing, or I've thought about this magazine forever, and it's a guy I know, and I just never clicked. It's just, I don't know.
Sounds like you're kind of interested in idiosyncratic, you said personal, I think is the word you used, but sort of like unique kind of individual voices. I think there's a big difference. Like I love like Forced Exposure and Your Flesh and all the different voices they brought together. What I appreciate about fanzines like Wipeout is it's mostly like a one-man show, right? I've only seen like 2.5 issues of it, so you're gonna have to fill in some of the blanks, but mostly it's you, Eric, right? It's kind of the slant of this, what, you know, like the unhinged kind of ramblings of like one person, very idiosyncratic take on things. And that wouldn't necessarily fit into like a context of like a magazine with a lot of contributors, but there's something special about entering to like one person's kind of musical universe and seeing things through their lens and hearing things through their ears.
Yeah, it was, I didn't really, for all the work I put into it, I didn't take it seriously. I wasn't trying to, I don't know, really, I really did not take it seriously. I did appreciate the fact that it gave you a reason to go talk to people like David Yao or something. It was like, I don't know if I would just walk up to him and say, hey, you know, can I ask you about, you know, your musical influences or something? Mm-hmm. But if you've got a fanzine, you know, it gives you a little bit of an in for that. But yeah, it was me, I guess, Jay Hinman. I was looking back at something, trying to do a little prep for this interview, and he said that he had submitted some things. So I guess I did get some outside input. I didn't even remember taking ads, but at some point I had ads.
There's a lot of ads in the issues I've seen. Yeah.
I know. I was like, somebody, I really like the grimy Xerox look of just stuff cut out of old magazines and thrown in there, stolen pictures and things. I mean, still to me, I was looking at Jay sent me the scans of the old magazines. I was like, that looks really good. You know, that aesthetic still works for me. I think the things that I was trying to copy was Forced Exposure seemed like they had an attitude about everything and they didn't care what anybody thought about what they were writing. And Kix magazine just had so much energy and was unearthing all kinds of music that you'd never heard of, Forced Exposure too. And that both of those were really, really exciting. And Super Dope or something like that, where it comes at it really kind of in a smart way and has some sense of history and knowledge behind it. That kind of stuff really appealed to me. And I thought my take on it was just sort of a joke. I started with issue number 4, because I thought no one cared about a first issue, because who's this guy doing a fanzine? I don't care. But if you've done 4 issues, maybe it's something to pay attention to. So the extremely rare 1-3 copy, you know, issues, if anybody has them, let me know, because I didn't write them.
I didn't know that. That's good to know. It's funny, you mentioned Jay Hinman of Super Dope. He did this post the other day, and it's this weird like parallel thinking. Jay mentioned like the early 90s as being kind of this age of particular fanzines that are like Forced Exposure derived, but on a smaller scale. He mentioned you, Mark Masters of Crank, himself, and Tim Ellison. And it's hilarious because last week, as I was preparing this, before he posted that thing, I had the four of you guys in those fanzines all listed together. And Glenn Galloway of Zero Gravity, what is my question here? Do you see, is there something to that, the early 90s, late 80s, as this kind of like second or third, like golden age of like small scale, personal underground fanzines? Did you see yourself as part of that at all?
I mean, now I, looking back, I could see it, you know, it's like there's real magazines up here and then Force Exposure and even like Maximum Rock and Roll and Flipside, I would put it as like more established kind of magazines documenting whatever's going on. And then there's the level below that of everybody that kind of takes their own, you know, individual kind of take on all that. I could see that, you know, there's some weird stuff that was going on with fanzines in the 90s. Did you ever see Blue Persuasion?
No.
Aaron Lee is a genius, but he was from Louisville, I think. And it was sort of tied up in porn and then music reviews and stuff. But it was at the time when Larry Flint was raiding fanzine guys to go work for Hustler. And so he's a very smart guy, and he's ended up, I can't remember, he's a screenwriter and a showrunner and stuff in Hollywood now. But it was just this weird thing where somebody out on the West Coast that was running these magazines said, you know, we could get these guys, they're doing these good magazines for free. We probably don't have to pay them anything, you know. And maybe a naked girl will walk by every once in a while, you know. I'm sure that's enough to get people out there, you know. It was his fanzine was another one in that realm that was really inspirational to me. It's just, you know, there was a lot of really good writing, really interesting takes on stuff. And mine was so, I mean, looking back on it, I was just really amped up on coffee and really did not care about making sense. I was like real time listening to records, reviewing them. If you asked me 5 minutes after I wrote the review, if I felt the same way, I might not feel the same way. Mm. You know, it was really sort of a, this is what I'm going to say about it now and take it or leave it, you know, which is kind of a weird way to go through it. And some things make sense, some things don't make sense. I was thinking about this when I first put out one of the magazines. I had a local band come up to me, and this was sort of, never really thought about this on a personal level, but you know, I had just kind of blasted out some, you know, sub SST boogie rock butt wagon something, you know. And the band came up to me and was like, what does this mean? What are you talking about? We do not sound like this. I was like, dude, I just wrote it in half a second. But I was like, you know, if you're writing about somebody's band, maybe you should think about it a little bit more, or you're going to get called out on it. You know, most of the time I don't care. You know, I'm like, yeah, you sound like SST bands and wagging your butt like Black Sabbath, whatever, you know. But that kind of interaction, a lot of the, you know, when you're writing the fanzine, you don't really feel like someone's going to call you out on it.
Yeah. You're like, who could possibly care? But people cared, obviously. Right. Like, right. Did you find that your approach changed over time? Did you find like, boy, I better like take my craft seriously and, you know, Wipeout is growing in distribution and in reputation. I really better, you know, kind of take this a bit more seriously and responsibly.
That sounds like something that I should have done, but I don't think I
did. No, I don't think so.
You know, I did Oblivion's got to go on tour with Country Teasers for 3 months. I did, one of the issues is a Country Teasers tour diary that I did and Ben Wallers did. And I put that in there, and I put my tour diary in like 4-point type in Old English font just to be completely unreadable. And now that I don't have the original files, I really wish I could read this thing. So it's all this stuff comes back to bite you in the end. So no, but the answer is no, I don't think I took it much more seriously. these things are huge. I mean, they're really thick. I put a lot of time in writing and listening to stuff and putting them together. And I'm sure other people have talked to you about this, but I put out the fanzine and expected to sell like 50 copies. And Tower Records at the time decided they were going to sell fanzines, and they bought like 300 of them, you know. And yeah, all of a sudden I have to figure out how to pay for 300 copies. I can't, you know, steal 300 copies from Kinko's as easily as I can like 10 copies. So it turned into more of a legitimate thing, my silly magazine going out. And Tower was great. I mean, it was such a good thing. I would go to Tower and buy fanzines, and for a semi-corporate thing, you know, you had See Here in New York buying fanzines and Tower. And both of those really serve purpose, you know, in different ways.
Yeah, yeah. Tower also, to their credit, were amazing at paying as well too. Like,
yeah,
they're obviously a huge outfit, so they were set up for that, but just reliable and willing to take a chance on things. I'm curious about, I've seen, what issues do I have? So Jay Hinman, our mutual friend, kindly scanned me a bunch of issues. So I think issue 5, issue 7, and then some random things from other issues. I'm curious about some of the people you interviewed. When I started a fanzine, I was excited about interviewing people. I wasn't excited about doing record reviews, but I was excited about the interviews. Did you get a kick out of interviewing? You mentioned Jesus Lizard. There's a pretty like weird Teen Generate interview that you did as well too, that is hard to decipher, but hilarious. Tell me about some of the interviews you did for Wipeout.
Yeah, I looked at that Teen Generate. That was a weird one because I just ran into Fink from Teen Generate. He was passing through Memphis for some reason. I decided to interview him in a bar, and I think most of it was, I couldn't hear what we had said anyway, so half of it might be made up. But yeah, actually the weird thing is the interviews weren't that. Now I really like talking to people about stuff, and I'm really curious about what they're doing. Then I don't know that I really had an angle on, you know, that it was my place to really bug these people, or that I had any reason. It seemed maybe because other fanzines were doing it, you know. Now it's like every podcast is out interviewing everybody, but it's still interesting to me. Then I thought that, you know, we don't need another helmet interview. There's already a helmet interview out there. But in terms of like, I would do a small article on the San Mateo Radio X supercharger and the Donnas and all that. But I didn't have like a, hey, maybe I should try to interview somebody and figure out what's going on, you know. That just never really crossed my mind. But, you know, at the same time, I did end up, you know, talking to David Yao, and if the opportunity was there and it seemed like a fun thing to do, I did get to do it. And that was a great thing about having a fanzine, you know, especially a silly thing I didn't take seriously. It still got me into shows. It got me to talk to people that I thought that I admired at the time.
I had this not very profound thought as I was reading Wipeout last week.
That's what it leads to. Not
no, 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 but it was, not. But it was semi-profound, but like, I don't aspire to profundity often, but I've got it written down here. So it's going to jog my memory. I was reading your reviews, and I spent a couple of straight hours just reading Wipeout.
And ouch.
Yeah, no, no, no. It was good. It was the highlight of the week, that kind of thing. And here's what I thought. I thought, this guy's trying to get inside the music in any way he can. You're coming at it from different angles. You've got stream of consciousness. You've got these long sentences. You've got these short sentences and words that just interrupt it. And you're just, in your writing, you're just trying to get at it from different angles and come to grips with it. And maybe you're influenced by the music itself. You, like Jay Hinman, posted this Truman's Water review you did on his blog, and yeah, it's like, it's a little like, it's obtuse and strange, but it could also be trying to like match what's going on in the music. Coffee, you mentioned, might be a factor in there too. Yes. I don't have a question here. I'm just tossing this out there.
Yeah, no, I saw Jay's thing and I thought, That is what I was doing. I was listening to it in real time, you know, kind of riffing off how the stuff was hitting me and related to other things that were going on. And sometimes it made sense to me. Sometimes I was just pulling things out of thin air that no one would understand. And one weird thing that I have had happen when rereading these things was, I think I was going so fast and just blasting these things out. And I read something, I wish I knew, I could think of what it was, but I said, man, that is really good. How did I do that? Yeah, it was a thought that did not seem like my thought that I had put down in a review or something, but it, to me, it was really profound. And it was like, how did I come up with that? You know, and maybe I learned something from myself. It was really weird. You know, I think if you write something, you should already know that, or you should remember that, you know, that maybe that's not the case, but to me, it was very strange, finding something of value in my writing.
No, I'm shocked. It's not better known. Like, your writing is, though. I'm curious about what you just said about, like, wow, I did that. Do you experience that when you're making music as well too? Like, have you gone back and listened to Oblivions or anything else that you've written and said, jeepers, I really got it right there. And that's not like that came from me.
Yeah. Well, you almost got it right there. It was, especially with music, I would say I'm a better writer than I am a guitar player and a musician. So the parts where I was like, I got it right. You know, I actually did that in music, especially. We have I have a band called True Sons of Thunder, and we have a really long kind of epic kind of heavy metal song, and we were playing this at this festival thing in front of like 50 people, and there's a guy in town from the Rock City Angels, Bobby Durango, who's passed on, but he was in a kind of hair metal band and everything, and he's standing right up front, and I do this solo, and I don't know what I'm doing on the solo, but every note was perfect in this thing. And Bobby was like nodding his head, and I was like, wow, that was great. You know, but that's the essence of everything there. It was totally accidental, total luck. You know, you get lucky sometimes with the music. I guess it does happen like that. You know, maybe if you do it enough, or you just put yourself, you know, if it's a crazy environment, things can happen. And I think that's sort of what the Wipeout is. That's sort of what my bands have been. It's never too much fun for me if it's predictable. I started thinking about this way too much last night, but, and I'm sure there's people that could tell me more about it, but having chaos in your life is, you know, is exciting and probably a crutch and probably keeps you from doing other things, but it's sort of, it also makes it exciting. And I think that's sort of what I do with a lot of this stuff, you know.
What we were talking about earlier about these kind of idiosyncratic fanzines that are just like the creator just doing their thing, and it probably wouldn't fit into context with other people. I think that's the context where people stick their necks out and do risky, fun, adventurous things, where it's like, boy, that one flopped, but that other review like totally nailed it. They just totally went for it and achieved something there that you're not going to read in Magnet or alternative press. I don't want to pick on publications, but
no, of course. Right. No, you're right. I mean, those magazines do their thing, and you know, you don't want Magnet to have some stream of consciousness review in the middle of their stuff. It's not what it's for. I'm reading Edgewise, a book about Cookie Mueller, and she had a review column in art reviews in Details, which was really crazy because she was just chaos in high heels, you know. But she had the same thing. She just had a lot of life in her. She would come up with unique attitudes, and she got away with this stuff in the context of a mainstream magazine, which I thought was really great. Yeah, I had somewhere else to go with that for fanzines, but forgot where it was.
That's all good.
Oh, I know what it was. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
One of my all time favorites is Banana Fish. Mm. And to this day, I don't know. I finally met Seymour Glass, Earl Cook, whatever his name really is. And he did a show at our shop to basically me and a few friends, but his magazine, I don't know what is going on in his magazine. I don't know if those interviews are real. I don't know if half the reviews, they take some strange angle on everything. And that was just fascinating to me that you could take the fanzine format and twist it so far and still be informative about the music, or at least turn you on to music enough that you would want to go seek this stuff out. But yeah, that to me is, complete art. And, you mentioned Truman's Water and Glenn, all that kind of stuff, it's just so left field but coherent in its own way. Mm-hmm. That was real inspirational to me as I was doing stuff in the 90s. Tom Lax and Seymour Glass are just two big, I mean, in my mind, they're like two of the best writers I've ever read. They're mm-hmm. just the way that they can take off on things that are just really wild. And it's in the, they probably should be writing books, but it's in this fanzine format that I love, and it just really clicked for me. I still love it.
I feel like everybody at some point is a poser and afraid of embracing and kind of forming their own taste. I think this is true of like fanzines as well too. If you read a lot of underground fanzines, people loving the exact same things. Is that something you ever ran into where you're like, damn it, it feels like I'm supposed to like this, but I don't actually like it. Is that something you're ever conscious of where you started like developing your own taste and pushing back on like, yeah, Byron Coley says this is good, but this is like third generation SST sort of trash or whatever. And like, I'm not buying it.
I think I did, but I think it was more, I wasn't pushing back on Byron Coley, or I wasn't pushing back on the Estrus thing. I was pushing back on myself trying to go along with the stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think it would be more like, hey, I like this stuff. I think this is great, but I'm really just going along with what I read or what I thought other people were into. And I mean, I think that's basically the same thing that you put out there. I came to the realization, hey, all this stuff isn't for me. But and really looking back on stuff, I have come around and I like things that I didn't like then more because I had a knee-jerk reaction that I got out of Force Exposure and these things. It was a lot easier to not like things and kind of slam them. And turns out that I actually do like that stuff. And I was not seeing that those, whatever it was, that music or those kind of bands were doing things that were interesting and different. But because there was kind of a, because Force Exposure didn't like reggae, I didn't like reggae, that kind of thing. At the same time, I've gone the other direction on other things, but it is meeting people, seeing bands, seeing how bands work, seeing that records aren't always exactly what a band sounds like. Slamming a band for a record is not always fair. There's just all kinds of things. As you get older, your tastes change. So.
What was some of the stuff you're really into? You mentioned the San Mateo, San Francisco kind of scene. Tell me a bit about that. Jay Hinman wrote that like Jay was actually there living in San Francisco and seeing this stuff and experiencing it. And he said you had a better handle on this stuff than he did. And you're from Memphis.
I had a record store. And this is another person that I don't know if his name came up, but Scott McCoy from the Rocket. from the Young Fresh Fellows. He might add a fanzine at some point, but he did a column for The Rocket, which was an amazing magazine out of Seattle. It was a weekly, but I think it was music based. Maybe not. But he had a column, and I don't know why I read the Rocket in Memphis, but I did. And he had a column about the Supercharger record and how great the Supercharger record is. So I set off, you know, I sent my money to wherever he said to send my money, and got into that. And that just blew my mind, the lo-fi aesthetic that Darren Raffaelli had, you know, kind of set out for himself. That Supercharger did. He put the Donnas starting out doing that. The Ripoffs and Ripoff Records kind of followed in that thing. But I think it was Darren that started it. And I was just really into it, and, you know, started, you know, ordering records and getting to know those guys a little bit. The Phantom Surfers were in there, and they were on a U.S. tour, and they came and played at the store I was working at, Shangri-La, at the time. And I don't know. Maybe because it was so close to Jay, he didn't really value it. There was nothing like that close to me that I knew about. So it was really cool and exotic to me. You might see the bass player from the, you know, Phantom Surfers walking down the street in San Francisco, and all of a sudden the mystique's gone. But while I'm in Memphis, you know, thinking about him all the time, it was great.
And how do you think that stuff has held up for you, at least?
I love it. I for whatever reason, I think Darren was a really good songwriter, really good producer. You know, that sounds funny because it sounds so bad, but the Donna's record sounds amazing. Yeah, the Brentwoods record is pretty shrill, hard to listen to. I still like it. I was really excited to see the Brentwoods play at Budget Rock Showcase out in San Francisco 10, 15 years ago, whenever that was. Trash Women, same way. All these bands were fun. They had good songs. I don't know. It does hold up to me. I could listen to it. I could understand why some people would kind of not want to listen to it. But to me, it sounds better than all the kind of hot rod estrus bands that were coming out that were just basically kind of, I don't know, revved up rock and roll that wasn't really an original take. Some of those bands were good, but there were just a lot of them at the time.
You also did a Japanese noise column in at least in every issue of Wipeout that I've come across. Tell me about your love for all things Japanese.
Yeah, I love the Japanese rock and roll type of stuff. It just really seemed the good bands were really good and the sloppy bands were really sloppy. And it's kind of the Japanese do everything to the ultimate aesthetic or ethos or whatever. Guitar Wolf was the first record I put out on my label, Goner. And at the time I thought, you know, I was really into that lo-fi kind of budget rock thing, which, you know, was hopefully a way to be kind of honest and not hiding behind production or acting like you're anything other than a trashy rock and roll band. And Guitar Wolf was just completely blown out, barely could play at the time, really fun. And I love that stuff. And I think that crossed the kind of attack mentality crossed over into the noise that was coming out that I was hearing. And I didn't know that much about the noise thing, but it was, I did enjoy listening to that stuff because it was new to me at the time. Masana and Ichigo Kaidan and all these bands, Murs Bow. It was, to me, it was a kind of brain clearing blast. That, you know, obviously doesn't really on the surface go with Supercharger or anything, but in terms of just being kind of outside of the ordinary thing and a raw full-on approach, I think they're similar in some ways. So I think that was my interest in them. That's where it was from. It opened up. There's a guy in town, Mike Honeycutt, who did a noise show, kind of abstract sound, I would say, show on the local radio station for years and years and years. And he turned me on to a lot of stuff. He knew all about that stuff. He had done a fanzine in the 80s called Malice that was great. And there was a whole history of that kind of stuff in Memphis that I didn't know about at the time. You know, I was doing my fanzine, just rolling around like I knew something and I didn't, you know. there's a history there. He's a good friend of mine. He was in a band with the singer for True Sons of Thunder, Richard Martin. They were in Victimized Carcass and Corn for Texture and some other bands down the line that were kind of space rock slash noise bands.
I especially enjoy the Japanese stuff you wrote on, because a lot of it was, like you said, stuff that's a bit outside of your, like the garage stuff that was like your bread and butter. I always find it interesting to read people who are, just trying to figure out like how they actually feel about these things and responding to it really impressionistically and just,
You know, I still, even with the store, you know, I think people think Goner is like a garage rock store. Mm-hmm. And we do sell a lot of Cramps records or whatever, you know, those kind of Liars records or whatever. That's what people come to the store for. But I'm interested in a lot of different stuff. And lately, you know, in the last 10, 15 years, the international stuff that's been reissued, that has really blown my mind. And bands going right now, the Meridian Brothers and things like that. That is, I mean, I love that stuff. So, it all kind of combines, it all goes together. But I think people from outside that know a little bit about the store might think that it's one thing, and it's a variety of all kinds of different music that I think is good, interesting, and you know, it's kind of where I've changed my focus rather than writing about it, stocking it, and trying to turn people onto it.
Mm-hmm. Does Goner stock fanzines?
We do. What did I just get in? I'm looking at my store now. Let's see. Oh, faux wood paneling. We just got in that.
Oh, okay. Yeah, the Richard Meltzer, Wade. Meltzer fan club, dude.
Yep, we got those in. I just was talking about a guy who did a tiki fanzine out of Denver that I saw online. I said, that's 44 pages. That looks pretty good. Why don't you send me some of those? So, I stock the stuff. One of the guys that I work with, Phillips Allen does he's a big fanzine guy. So I know I could sell one to Phillips, whatever I get in. He just wrote a book that Goner put out about 101 movies you can see before you die. Not necessarily have to. And he's a great writer. I really enjoy his stuff, but he did, can't think of what his fanzine's called now. We try to support the people still doing fanzines. We love the format. I think it's still a viable thing. I was just talking for my podcast to Joe from Celluloid Lunch, and
Canadian.
His fanzine was basically kept everything going for a while. And we stock that and all kinds of stuff. So yes, we do stock fanzines.
Respect. And you're publishing books. You said you published your staff member's book. Are you guys getting into books? Have I missed something?
I love books.
Like, you guys publishing, you published a bunch of things, and
we did, our first book was a Quintron book, Europa, My Mirror, which was kind of tour diary stuff from Quintron in New Orleans. It's really great. He's a fantastic writer. We did a book of Jeff Mahana's artwork which is not suitable for minors, not suitable for most adults as well. We couldn't get it printed anywhere. So that was a good experience for a publisher. And yeah, we did Billups' book, and books are great. You can get books printed in like 4 weeks. It's not like records. So, you know, I understand why Hozak has been putting out books as well as records. It's fun. There's a good turnaround, and there's a lot of good writers out there with something to say. I love the Hozak books that they've been doing. Yeah, so maybe that's an inspiration there.
You think you'll write again?
I was going back through looking for an address for Hozak, and they had asked me to do in 2016, they asked me to do a Wipeout collection. I said no, and I still say no. But what I really wanted to do was a history of the Goner Bulletin Board. Through the 90s, we had a bulletin board that was really wild and really cool, and a lot of people were on there, and it served as your social media before there was really such a thing. And it started probably in like 94 and completely crashed one time, but we didn't keep an archive of it. And I cut out, we had done a Goner cookbook at 1.2. I guess that was the first book we had published. And that was basically recipes that we had compiled through the Goner Bulletin Board. And I had just cut pieces off the internet, just kind of screen grabbed discussions from the bulletin board and put those in the magazine or in the cookbook. But it was really interesting group of people that came together from music, but really the discussions and everything went a lot wider. I don't know why I thought that would be a good book, but at some point that was more interesting to me than rehashing this fanzine that I kind of just bashed out. Maybe I should read the fanzines and see if they're worth putting out.
I'd say they are.
Other reviews can go away. Or maybe selected reviews could stay, and maybe the interviews or some parts. I still, like I said, I want to read the Country Teasers interview or tour diary. That's a lot of fun. It's hard to figure out what kind of writing. At one point I did, when Goner was just a mail order thing out of my apartment, I did these catalogs that I did long descriptions or paragraph descriptions of records and things, and that was kind of a way to be writing and interesting take on things. And I don't have time to do that for everything that comes in the shop. I'd love to do that. So I don't know. It seems like between blurbs for bands and all the press stuff that we do and Gonerfest, right now I'm in the middle of putting together our program guide for that, which is basically a 80 page magazine that we put together in a month. That just about kills us every time we do this festival. The festival is no problem. This program guide thing is brutal. There's enough outlets for doing this stuff that, I feel like I'm doing writing. I don't know where it's going. I got a piece in Tim Heinle's, Where the Wild Gigs Are.
No way.
Yeah. And yeah, you know, I'm always writing something. It probably makes even less sense than it did back in the Wipeout days.
Thank you so much to Eric for taking the time to chat with us. If you come across original issues of Wipeout, pick them up. They're really hard to come by and amazing. Or feel free to drop me a line. You can connect with me on Twitter. The handle is @RockRitPod. I'd be happy to hook you up with some scans of Wipeout, or email achemag@yahoo.ca. So that's achemag@yahoo.ca. Which just leaves me to thank you, our merry band of listeners, for another year of support. much appreciated. Wishing you the merriest of Christmases and all the very best in 2024. We shall see you then. Cheers.